This podcast is supported by The Real Real.
You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable, pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Welcome to The Vegan Report. My name is Ryan, and today I want to ask you, which do you think is the most effective animal charity out there? The one that has moved the animal rights movement forward the most? Well, for the last 12 consecutive years, there is one animal charity that has been evaluated and recommended again and again and again by animal charity evaluators, and its name is the Humane League. Have you heard of them? I think of them as the smart kid of the class, always getting an A+. That got me curious. Why has it been deemed such a successful charity? What explains their success? To get some answers, I have with me none other than the CEO of the Humane League, Dan Shannon. Dan and I discussed, among other things, who is his favorite employee, does he think Big Ag spies on his nonprofit, the secret agenda of the welfare reforms he is passing, and how he takes care of the mental health of his employees. Check the episode notes for a link to connect with the Humane League. And as always, thank you so much for listening. Follow or subscribe to the show. And don't miss next week's 100th episode. Share the episode with the vegans you know. Let's shed light on the important work of the Humane League. Thank you. So last Wednesday, the Science of Activism episode was about the animal charity evaluators, and they described their list of 10 recommended charities. And I looked the Humane League up and discovered that you were part of that list since forever, since the creation of the Animal Charity Evaluators Initiative. And so I guess my first question for you is, what explains how efficient you are at doing progress?
Yeah, we're delighted to be named for the 12th year in a row, very privileged and honored to be a part of the list. I think our work is cost effective by nature, and I think that's one of the things that animal charity evaluators looks for in us. And it's cost effective by nature in that our core theory of change at the Humane League is changing institutional policy to eliminate the worst abuses of farmed animals. So particularly corporate policy and then public policy. And when we're working in that way, right, individuals like you or me, we can make decisions in our lives that might impact dozens of animals, hundreds of animals, right? I've been vegan for almost 30 years. I've affected 1,000 animals, right, with my personal choices, but companies can make decisions that affect millions of animals at scale, right? And so when our work is about applying public pressure, activist pressure, primarily to companies, to get them to make policy choices that eliminate the worst abuses of farmed animals in their supply chain, with relatively little effort, and I don't want to value the very important work folks on my team do, it is hard work, but we can make changes to corporate policy that affects animals by the millions. Right. And when you with that formula, I think we can be very cost effective with the number of animals' lives that we can improve with just, phone calls, meetings and negotiations. Of course, we will often have to go to a public campaign, a public activist pressure campaign, if companies aren't willing to make changes through dialogue and negotiation alone. But the majority of change that we make is actually just through dialogue and negotiation, which leaves us being very cost effective, which is, I think, one of the things that Animal Charity Evaluators has really valued in our work.
Amazing. Yes, hard work, but also expert work. You know, I would not know where to start, you know, in order to make a corporation receptive to my message of compassion for animals. And so let's talk about this. Starting with, how do you decide, you know, which corporation to target?
So we have a large research team at the Humane League that does extensive research to understand where our best leverage points are with the industry. And that looks a couple of different ways. One, it looks at scale of animals impacted by supply chains, right? As you can imagine, most companies are not publishing, oh, we have 6 million hens living in cages in our supply chain right now, right? We have to do digging and research and get into industry publications and government reports to really be able to construct a picture of what corporate supply chains and industries look like. So a lot of research goes into understanding which are the companies that are abusing the most animals in their supply chain, what regions of the world are those, are those concentrated in, et cetera, so we know who are the biggest targets to go after. A second stream of research is around then sort of how feasible it is for companies to make the kinds of changes that we're advocating for. So we often advocate, we primarily advocate for companies to move from using cruel battery cages, right, where you've got 4 to 6 egg-laying hens living in a wire cage the size of a file cabinet drawer for their entire lives, to you know, what we call cage-free environments. We should be clear that cage-free environments are also not great from an animal welfare perspective, but they do represent a meaningful improvement, right, over battery cages. But then we also try to understand how feasibly can companies make that change as their existing supply in the regions of the world that they purchase from, right, where they can actually get access to cage-free eggs through their supply chain, right? So we look at scale. We also look at tractability, right, whether or not a company can actually do what we're asking them to do. And then the third thing that we look at is the vulnerability of companies to public pressure, right? Different companies have different levels of tolerance for how much consumer pushback they're willing to absorb, right? Companies that have had a lot of other kind of issues or campaigns launched against them and they have been unresponsive to them, maybe more likely to not do what we're asking, right? Whereas companies that have a proven track record of responding to activist demands are more likely, right? And so we try to understand how likely is a company to say yes to what we're asking for. So it's sort of the combination of those three factors that our team researches kind of independently of one another that then informs our campaign strategy and who we choose to go after.
And going back to that strategy of being cost effective, I guess the corporation needs to be like a big corporation in order to have a greater impact. You won't be targeting like the local butcher shop.
That's right. Yeah, we try to go after companies that both, you know, are abusing animals by the hundreds of thousands or the millions in their supply chain where we can create the most impact. And also where a win with one particular company can help create progress in industry overall. To give you an example of what I mean by that, here in the US where I'm based, we are currently, over the past 20 years, you know, THL is celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. And in the over the past 20 years, the U.S. egg-laying industry has gone from, you know, maybe 1 to 2% cage-free, right, in terms of the number of hens that are living outside of caged environments, to now at about 45%, just over about 20 years, which is meaningful progress over a relatively short period of time. What we're left with here in the U.S. is primarily the grocery industry. So most of the 55% of hens that are still living in caged environments are part of the grocery industry supply chain, that they're the largest retailer and seller of eggs as an industry in the U.S. And we have made very little progress, if we're being honest, in the grocery industry, right? So when we look at target selection for an industry like grocery, where we're trying to get in the door and really create, is that we need to find a campaign that's winnable enough so that it can be, we can get a company to be the first to make this kind of change in their industry. Because often companies are very reluctant to be the first company in their industry to want to make any kind of change, whether it's animal welfare related or anything else. But once you have a proof point that you can point to, then a lot of the other victories become a lot easier, right? Because you're not asking them to be the first to do it. So along with other coalition partners and allies in the movement that we work with, we've identified a company called Ahold Delhaize, which is a grocery company that owns a bunch of regional grocery chains in the US, Stop and Shop, Food Lion, a bunch of other ones. They're not the biggest industry. They're not the biggest player in the industry. I believe they're the seventh largest grocery chain, but we believe they're the one that would be the most susceptible to public pressure and the most likely to concede, right, to our demands. So our strategy is if we can get this company to go first, right, and make it and go 100% cage-free in their supply chain, the bigger companies will follow suit, right? So campaign target selection is often about kind of what would the domino effects on the rest of the industry that these companies operate in, as much as it is the individual scale that that company is operating on.
I want to go back to talking about what kind of changes you're asking those corporations to implement. You mentioned, you know, going cage-free. Now, is there an underlying, I guess, another agenda to, you know, asking to those corporations to make that change? You know, so we're not only doing it for, you know, the welfare of animals, but also with a bigger strategy, long-term strategy of maybe making it more costly to exploit those animals.
Yes, it's exactly what you said. I think there are there's several ways that I think about this. As I said, I think we have to be realistic with ourselves that even a company, even a leg-laying hen going from a battery cage to a cage-free environment, this animal is still suffering and is still living a life of misery. We have to be realistic with ourselves about that. It is both meaningful progress and a significant improvement, and yet far from ideal or what I think any kind, decent person would think would be appropriate for an animal to live in. So we have to be clear-eyed about that. But as you said, I think there are two additional benefits to doing these kinds of corporate welfare campaigns that are beyond the meaningful suffering reduction. I think the meaningful suffering reduction is enough in and of itself. I want to be clear about that. And I think it accomplishes two long-term objectives. So when we talk about the worst abuses of factory farming, even through the lens of ending them, we are increasing people's awareness about how animals suffer on factory farms. And I think the more that we talk about the cruelty of this industry and the more that we shine a light on the reality that the industry spends millions of dollars, billions of dollars to prevent people from understanding, the more we build a shared collective understanding that factory farming is bad for animals. And I do think that that moves us closer to a world where no animals are being raised and killed for food, which is the world that we all, well, those of us who are listening to this podcast, all of us would like to live in. So I do feel like it helps advance the cultural saliency of the issue of factory farming and does cause people to think differently about their relationship to animals raised for food. And then what you said, I think, is the second way that I think about it, which is that it shrinks the factory farming industry's ability to operate. I think that every industry has to operate within what I call a box, right? A box that's kind of defined by kind of three things. So what is financially viable, right? These are companies that are trying to make money. What's legally permissible and what's socially acceptable? What customers and consumers will be willing to tolerate, right? And I think corporate welfare campaigns meaningfully reduce the size of the box that the factory farming industry has to operate in. I think it demonstrates to the companies directly that there is a limit to the amount of suffering and abuse that customers and consumers are willing to tolerate, including people who are not vegetarian or vegan, right? Which is obviously the overwhelming majority of the audience and the customer base for the grocery industry, for instance. And it does, you know, to your point, it does increase the cost of operation and reduces profit margin within the factory farming industry. It is more expensive, right, to raise egg-laying hens in cage-free environments than it is caged environments. The industry overplays how much more expensive it is. And actually most of the markup at retail is actually profit for the industry, right? There's sort of the humane tax, right, where they mark up the price of the eggs. But the fact is that it does, I think, incrementally each of these campaigns.
AI agents are everywhere, automating tasks and making decisions at machine speed. But agents make mistakes. Just one rogue agent can do big damage before you even notice. Rubrik Agent Cloud is the only platform that helps you monitor agents, set guardrails, and rewind mistakes, so you can unleash agents, not risk. Accelerate your AI transformation at rubrik.com. That's rubrik.com.
Gains shrinks the box that the factory farming industry can operate within. I don't think that corporate campaigns are going to bring us in and of themselves to the end of factory farming over any time horizon. I think more other work is needed. We need public policy reforms to enshrine into law protections for farmed animals. And of course, we do need behavior change at scale and a significant reduction of the consumption of animal products. At the Humane League, we try to be very focused in our work. And going back to the idea of cost effectiveness and sort of why I believe we've been effective as an organization, I think one of the reasons we're effective is that we try to stay in our lane. I believe many strategies are required to bring about the end of factory farming and the end of the abuse of animals used for food. But I think each individual organization is more effective if we focus on a strategy. Our strategy at the Humane League is applying public pressure to companies to eliminate the worst abuses, and that's what we do, and I think we do it very well. And other work will be required to get us to the outcome that we want in the long run. And we respect that, and we welcome all the other activists and organizations in the movement that are doing that important work.
I think for most activists out there, the default mode of activism is to convince people to go vegan, and so to address, the general public. But there is the issue of, are corporations actually shaping those behaviors from the public? And shouldn't we, target the source of that marketing? Have you discussed that or done something around that at the Humane League?
Yeah, our focus is really exclusively about applying public pressure to companies to eliminate the worst abuses. So in the past, THL has gone through different iterations over the years. There have been times in our past where we've done a lot of vegan outreach work and vegan advocacy work. We've moved away from that strategically, again, not because we don't think that it's important work that somebody ought to be doing, but we think we can best play our role in the movement if we are focused, and pick one job to do and choose to do it very well. So I would say it is a strategic decision, right, that we do not kind of engage in vegan outreach and advocacy. Again, not that we don't think it's important and we don't think it's part of the solution. There are many organizations who do that work very well, right? And we support them and celebrate them doing that work. And our focus is on doing the work that I think we do well, which is improving as we work towards that long-term vision of bringing about an end to factory farming and an end to the animals being abused for food, make meaningful progress in reducing their suffering in the meantime, which I do believe we have a moral and ethical obligation to do.
Great. I want to ask you about, yes, you ask companies to adopt, welfare practices. But if there is the option of going full vegan, for instance, by adopting cell-based meat or something of the sort, would you consider, adopting that tactic?
Certainly in the future, as those technologies become more readily available, I think that could be an option for us. I think at THL, we will always do what we think is going to be the most effective at reducing the suffering of farmed animals. That's our mission, right? At the moment, I believe, and we believe as an organization, that the best role that we can play in doing that is by advocating for, again, the end of the use of battery cages and things of that nature. That may change over time. I think it will. I'll rephrase that. I believe that in the next 5 years, we're going to get to a point, at least in the US, where the use of battery cages is reaching a tipping point. We're currently at about half of the industry is currently cage-free. Within 5 years, we think we can get to about two-thirds. And you do get to a point with these industry-wide changes where once you've reached a certain threshold, market factors more or less kind of finish the job from there. It becomes untenable to be one of the very few producers in the industry who's relying on this outdated technology, whatever that technology happens to be. So as we get closer and closer to that point, our strategy will need to change, right? It's unlikely that we will still be doing cage-free work in 20 years because we probably will have won on that issue, right? Perhaps at that point, cell-based meat is at a point where corporate advocacy to encourage companies to use that as opposed to real animal protein, that could very well be the direction that we choose to move in. I like to say that THL is not, we are not a particularly ideological organization. We are a very practical organization. Our ideology is that we're trying to end the abuse of animals used for food. And then we are very tactical and practical about what choices we, what kind of work we engage in to try to do that. So we're not particularly attached to any one approach. It's really going to be what's going to be the most effective at reducing the suffering of farmed animals.
I love that. I'm also a practical person, so it appeals to me. And cell-based meat, you know, that has been on my mind this morning because of the whole Campbell scandal. I don't know if it reached you. No. Anyway, let's not get into it.
Fair enough.
Dan, I want to ask you about your role as CEO. And let me start with this. Who is your favorite employee at the Humane League and why?
My favorite employee
yes.
at the Humane League. I feel like I can't, I have a professional obligation not to give a straight answer to that question. But I'll say this, just last week I was out at a series of protests organized by the organizing and campaign staff at the Humane League at Ahold Delhaize headquarters in the United States, the grocery chain that we're targeting right now. We were very happy to be joined, not just by a number of THL staff and local volunteers, but also volunteers and staff from other grassroots animal advocacy organizations across the movement. It really felt like many organizations coming together and working in tandem to apply public pressure to this company to make this meaningful progress. And so I think about the team, like I am an organizer by training. That's my professional background. It's the work that I started out doing in my career. So I have a bias towards our organizing team and our organizing program, both because that's my skill set, but also because I think that some of the hardest work that we do in the movement is kind of bringing people together and actually getting people to come out and take action, right? It's one thing to listen to a podcast, for instance, right? It's another thing to make personal choices. These are all great things for people to do, but really the way that we change the world and we make progress towards the end goal that we want is by people taking advocacy actions. I feel very strongly about that. And so I think our organizing team, that's their job, is to try to build relationships with activists and supporters, connect them with opportunities in their community to take action in meaningful ways that can move the ball forward for farmed animals. And so I'm not going to pick a single favorite employee, but I will say I think that work of kind of building community power and deploying it to create change for animals is the most important work that we do as an organization and as a movement.
It was a bit of a tongue-in-cheek question. I mean, it's important to humanize, you know, the people, the organizations. Often we focus too much on the brand, you know, but who are the people behind, you know, the Humane League? Okay, let me ask you about how to keep your employees motivated and I guess how to take care of their mental health. It's a problem in this community. I would even say it's a crisis among animal rights activists. And there are too many, you know, groups and communities that just don't focus on that and keep things, you know, just unsupervised. And so what kind of, you know, culture do you put in place in the Humane League to make sure that everyone is happy?
It's a great question. And I agree with the premise of the question. It's what we really need as a movement is longevity. We need to build a movement that people feel like it can be a part of their lives for their entire lives. You know, whether that's as a paid professional staff member, an NGO, or an activist or a supporter, right? There's a lot of ways to be involved in the movement, but it does need to feel like a sustainable movement to be a part of, particularly in the professional wing of the movement. So a couple things I think a lot about at the Humane League. I think one is that Because, you know, we're a big nonprofit organization, so we have lots of campaigners and corporate outreach staff, you know, people who are doing the work that we do directly. And then we also have accountants and HR professionals and operations staff, right? People who do kind of quote unquote normal jobs, right, at the Humane League. And I think it's very important as a mission-driven organization to help people in those roles, right, understand the critical importance of their work to achieving our mission, right? It's obvious if you're a corporate negotiator, you understand that by negotiating with companies, you're helping us reduce the suffering of farmed animals. But also, like, somebody's got to process all the expense reports for the travel for those meetings, and somebody's got to make sure they have a computer that works so that they can send the email, right? And so I think helping people understand that connection between the role that they play at the organization and the impact that it makes, and like regularly communicating that back to them, helping them understand we won this victory and you made it possible with your work, and really drawing direct lines of connection between the effort that staff put in and the victories that we're able to achieve, especially where that's less obvious than it might otherwise be. One of the things that we talk a lot about at the Humane League is this idea of we are all campaigners. And that's sort of what that means, right? Some of us are literally campaigners. It's our job to manage and run campaigns. And other folks have roles with whom those campaigns are not possible, without whom those campaigns are not possible. And so even if you're an accountant, right, you are a campaigner because your work makes our campaigns possible. We encourage people then to also like get involved personally, right? Like if there's a protest taking place in your community, like you can come out and join us there, even if that's not a core part of your job. We had staff retreats this year. We had three different staff retreats. And as part of those staff retreats, we held protests against our campaign targets and encouraged all of our staff to join, just so that people have a sense of what that work looks like and can sort of have an experience of being a part of it directly. So I think that's a big motivational factor, is people really understanding the nature of what we do, how the role supports it, and having some opportunity to participate in it directly. And then in terms of mental health, as you said, and protecting against burnout and kind of ensuring that people can do this work for the long run, we try to be, to the degree that we can, as a budget limited nonprofit, we try to be generous with things like health benefits, mental wellness benefits, ensure that people have their healthcare needs met, including their mental health care needs met. They have access to mental health services when they need them. We try to be generous with our time off policies and our breaks so that people can rest and recover from the hard work that they do and then get back into action on the other side of it. A lot of that is just, I think, good nonprofit management. I think it's just good organizational management in general. But this is very hard and difficult work. And it's important to me that people feel that the organization recognizes that. Right, in the way that we compensate people, in the way that we, in the benefits that we provide, in the celebration that we provide to staff for the victories that we win. Nothing's worse than working hard and feeling invisible. And so we work very hard to try to help our staff feel visible in the victories that we achieve for animals.
What about your corporate partners? Do you, and it's kind of a weird question, but do you ever invite them to mix with the rest of the Humane League team?
When you say corporate partners, you mean the companies that we're negotiating with?
Yes.
Or campaigning? Yes. Not really is my answer. It's an interesting question. We talk a lot at the Humane League about what is the nature of our relationship with companies. Is it a friendly relationship, or is it an adversarial relationship? And there are different schools of thought about this. But I think there is a, and I think this may be perhaps another tongue-in-cheek question, but I think there's a real risk in thinking that our job is to build kind of positive relationships with the companies that we work with. I think that's not quite the right way to think about it. I think we need to be a feared and respected adversary, is sort of how I think about it. I feel very strongly, and I think anybody who does campaigns work would agree with, like, companies don't make positive forward progress on any issue, whether it's animals or any other issue, out of the goodness of their hearts. They do it because these are profit maximizing machines. They're soulless corporations. They do not have any sort of sense of what of a heart, let alone a good one. And so our job is to apply pressure and to force them to act. That pressure can simply be through negotiation, right? It doesn't always need to be through the form of a campaign. But implicit in all of our negotiations is the threat of a campaign, right? Because they can see us campaigning against other companies in the world. So I think it is very important that we sort of hold the line that we are not your friends and we are not here to make friends. We can have a productive and constructive relationship if we can work together to achieve the outcomes that we want. But if we can't, then it will go the other way in the form of a public campaign. And if they are unwilling to do that, then it is going to become an adversarial relationship. And that always needs to be an option.
So for those corporations, you know, they also have accountants and people who work from the office. They're not the ones, you know, handling the animals or slaughtering them. But just like, you know, every employee at the Humane League is a campaigner, they do collaborate in that suffering. I wonder, after one of your pressure campaign, did you hear of any employees from those corporations deciding to leave, you know, after understanding, after you exposed, you know, the suffering and what's happening behind closed doors?
I'm not aware of an instance where we've heard of an employee like leaving their job, full stop. We do pretty regularly get messages, like anonymous messages from employees saying things like, hey, I work here and I really support what you're doing and keep it up. Hmm. So, you know, when I say these companies don't have any, you know, they're like individual people who work at these companies may very well be supportive of the issue. And, you know, often we do have a counterpart that we're negotiating with who seems to mean well and want to work collaboratively together to make progress. But I think at the end of the day, we have to be clear-eyed that at the end of the day, these are business decisions and we need to make a business rationale, right, for making that decision, which is basically that the cost of not doing what we want will be greater than the cost of doing what we want. The cost is not necessarily, you know, you mentioned accountants and things like that. Like, our movement isn't really at a scale, if we're being honest with ourselves, that we can sort of boycott a company and sort of make a meaningful, right, kind of impact on their bottom line. The impact is often more reputational, right? These companies really just don't want their name and animal cruelty appearing side by side in the same news story or tweet or video or what have you. But yeah, we have to incentivize them to make, through negative incentives, right, to make the changes that we want.
What's the role of subsidies in all of that? I guess many of those corporations get a boost of confidence that, you know, you won't harm them because there are all of those subsidies in place.
I often say that if I could change a single thing about the animal agriculture industry, it would be, at least in the US, it would be the heavy subsidies that are provided to the industry by the government. I think, honestly, it's a linchpin that holds the whole industry together. Again, at least here in the United States, you know, it artificially suppresses the cost, right, of animal products significantly. I think the cost would be prohibitive for most people if those subsidies weren't in place. It does protect these companies financially and gives them allowed them over the years to scale and to grow and to reach the kind of market saturation that they have. So yes, the subsidies, particularly of you know, the animal agriculture industry, are a huge barrier that we will eventually have to find a way to overcome as a movement to ultimately get to the end state that we want.
Do you ever get paranoid, you know, by, you know, the power that those corporations hold? So, for instance, there have been several environmental organizations, foundations that have released reports stating that those big corporations and interests have spied on animal rights activists or have launched, you know, social media campaigns against those animal rights organizations. Have you been the target of that? Do you think of it often?
I don't think it's paranoid at all. I think it's just reality. I do have reason to believe that I myself personally in my career have been surveilled and watched by government agencies. Certainly companies have their own, as you acknowledge, private security and kind of intelligence apparatus that they use against activists. Absolutely. I think that is, we have to assume that that's happening to us at all times. I don't think that, I think it's practical and realistic to engage in that. And then also we just have to be confident that we are doing the right thing. This is where, you know, having lawyers on staff is important to understand kind of, okay, we are operating within the boundaries of the law, whether it's things like, you know, whether it's about protest activity and what's permissible, you know, things like libel and slander laws, right? It is very important that we are correct and defensible in all of the messaging that we use. And so, you know, we have to pay attention to that. But as long as we are doing the right things and protecting ourselves in the way that we need to, I feel strongly that we can't let it bother us. We just have to go move full steam ahead and do our work, and trust that if we are operating within the boundaries that we should be, that that we're going to be okay. It doesn't mean that they may not try to make our lives difficult, but it's hard work and we have to keep doing it.
Just a way to measure, you know, how big of a threat this is. Have you implemented measures when recruiting employees, you know, to see if they're generally, you know, caring for animals, or they're spies or something of the sort, you know, trying to infiltrate the Humane League?
Yeah, we don't do necessarily a sort of full-blown background check on every applicant. But obviously we do our screening. You know, I think the same, I think we do similar practices to what most mid-sized nonprofit organizations would have, call references, you know, ensure that people are who they're representing themselves to be. But this is just one of those areas where I think we just have to accept a little bit of risk sometimes and be confident that, and I am confident about this, right? That there's nothing we're doing at the Humane League that in terms of our communications, in terms of our tactics, in terms of what we talk about internally, that I wouldn't be comfortable seeing the light of day. I don't necessarily want every company to have insight into all of our different planning and our strategy and all that, but I'm very confident that even if somebody were to be inside the organization and kind of release a whole bunch of documents or whatever, we're not doing anything wrong. You know, so I think we have to just feel confident that we're doing the right thing and carry on with our work and not. I think we can twist ourselves up into knots trying to play defense. And I think that distracts us from our important work to play offense.
Definitely, I agree with that. Okay, so earlier you mentioned how it is important to make the work of your employee, you know, make them feel like this is meaningful work and make them feel like they have a share in the victories. I want to ask you about the victories, but first, the failures. I'm sure you have some failures. Can you, you know, name a few of those and how you dealt with, you know, the aftermath of those failures?
I can. I'm relatively new to my role here. I've been in my role for about 6 months. So so hopefully I haven't had too many big failures in 6 months. I will say that looking at the Humane League, though, historically and before my tenure, there's a well-known example in the movement. Some of your listeners may be familiar with it. There was a big campaign that a number of organizations led several years ago against McDonald's, trying to get McDonald's to make progress on broiler chicken welfare for chickens that are raised to be eaten as opposed to raised for eggs. A lot of time and energy was put into the campaign. It was, a well-run and strategically sound campaign, but it ultimately didn't bring about the victory that we had hoped. And ultimately, organizations had to make the decision to move on rather than continue to kind of bang their heads against this wall. We could look at that as a failure. I think that would be one way to look at that, because it was. We set out to achieve a goal and we didn't achieve it. And a lot of time and energy was put into that. And obviously that's always a shame when that happens. I also, though, another way I think about this, though, is I think we can't be afraid to fail as a movement. Obviously we want to win and we don't want to fail. But I feel very strongly that if we never fail at anything, it means that we're not trying hard enough and we're not stepping outside of our comfort zone. If we only do things as an organization or as a movement that we know are going to work, then we're never going to try anything new, right? And we're never going to innovate. We'll never find new approaches that may be even more effective than what we're doing currently. So I'd always prefer to win a campaign than lose a campaign. And I'd certainly prefer not to spend a lot of money on a campaign that we don't ultimately win. But I do feel like when we have those moments, the important thing to do is just kind of figure out what we can learn from them, right? And how that can inform our work to be more effective in the future and not sort of beat ourselves up over the fact that we didn't win this one. There will be failures. There have been, and there will continue to be. And I think we can't be afraid of them. We have to embrace failure as a part of the path to success.
I love that entrepreneurial spirit. Okay, let's talk about the victories. Which victory from the Humane League is your favorite one?
It's a great question. I'm going to go with a relatively recent one just because I'm relatively new to my role. Earlier this year, we won a campaign against Subway to get them to go 100% cage-free in all of their North American operations. And it was probably the biggest campaign that we've won in my tenure with THL, so that kind of makes it my favorite by default. But what I, beyond that, it isn't necessarily our single biggest campaign victory. We won, that victory impacted about 300,000 hens who will now live outside of battery cages as a result of the victory, which is not nothing, but we've also won campaigns where the hens are measured in the millions as opposed to the hundreds of thousands. But what I liked about the win with Subway is that it demonstrated a couple of things. It demonstrated a long-term strategy. This is a company that we've been working with for 10 years or more, not necessarily always in a public campaign mode, but in terms of working with them to try to get to this outcome, it's been a very long time coming. And I think it speaks to the value of sort of never giving up and not walking away. I also think that Subway, and I'm going to nerd out on the campaign strategy here for just a moment, but Subway is a heavily franchised company, right? So most Subway locations are franchise owned. And we took a different strategy with this campaign than we have taken with some previous campaigns, which is that we really focused on applying pressure to the franchisees in addition to the kind of the corporate mothership, if you will. And that seemed to work very effectively, right? Because if you think about the incentive structure, right? Subway is a big multinational organization, billion-dollar company, right? Like, but a Subway franchisee, they might own three Subways in their community, right? There are it's almost like a network of small businesses that have a lot more to lose, right? If we were to decide that we're going to target one of their franchisees, right, with a kind of pressure campaign. So what we found through this campaign is that actually applying pressure to those franchisees, in addition to the kind of corporate mothership, was very effective at building incentive across the corporate structure to adhere to the commitment that they had made. And I really liked that we found something new that we think works and we think can be applicable to future campaigns.
Am I hearing that you gain an appetite for replicating that with other businesses with the same, you know, business model?
Yeah, exactly that. It's, different companies are different, right? And it requires different types of tactics and strategies to win against different kinds of companies. And I do feel like, yeah, we found something that works with a particular kind of company here. And now we know that and we can have that in our toolbox for the future.
Yes, that's amazing. I love how this is a whole, a chess game. It feels that way. I guess, since you're a very successful nonprofit, what should other animal charities out there, animal causes, learn from the Humane League?
Well, I think, as I mentioned earlier, I think one of the secrets to our success is focus. And I think the movement needs a range of different approaches. I don't think everybody should be doing the same thing. But I do think organizations are stronger when they sort of pick one core theory of change, one core strategy for creating impact and going all in, right? For us, it's corporate welfare campaigns. For another organization, it might be vegan advocacy. For another, it might be public policy change. You know what I mean? But I do feel like, and I've worked at many organizations that are very scattered in their approach. They try to do a lot of things. And then by definition, they only do each of those things so well. So I think one piece of advice I would offer if folks are interested would be to kind of think about how to focus in on like a core thing that you can do really very well. And if we have enough of those groups doing enough of those core things very, very well, we'll have the coordinated movement-wide strategy that we need.
I think it's good advice. I've heard that before from successful entrepreneurs. You know, at least in the business world, it's something you hear often, how important it is to stay focused. Do you have a timeline in mind on, you know, when we could see true, you know, substantial progress in this movement?
Yeah, it all depends, I think, on what we mean by true substantial progress. One of the ways that I think about this question is factory farming is a relatively recent invention in the grand scheme of things. I'm sure your listeners are familiar with this, but you know, humans have been doing agriculture of various kinds for like 10,000 years, or quite a long time. And factory farming has got about 100 years of history. And so if you look at it as a kind of moment in time in the history of human agriculture, it's really quite a short moment. And I say that because I think for many people, you know, perhaps not your listeners, but for most kind of normal, typical consumers, I think they have this idea that this is just the way we've always done things, right? When I talk to people, I don't talk to anybody for the most part who says, I think it's great that animals suffer on factory farms. I think most people have some amount of sympathy for the idea that, like, yeah, that sounds pretty bad when you tell me about it. But I think it often runs up against this barrier of, but I don't know what else we would do, right? Like, and I think you see this a lot. You see this, at a previous stage of my career, I worked in the movement to end global poverty, right? And we saw there's a similar dynamic with the anti-poverty movement, right? If you try to convince somebody that poverty is bad, it doesn't really move the needle because people either already know that, like, it's, of course it is, or they don't care, in which case they're not going to do anything anyway. But if you can convince people that it's possible to end poverty, that message is very motivating because it actually does cut through what people's real mental barrier is, which is that, like, I know that it's bad that people live in poverty, but this is just the way that it's always been, right? And so I think about that point about factory farming being a relatively new invention, right? Really just a factor of the past 100 years of human history as a way to help people understand that it's like, we don't have to do it this way, right? And it's one thing to even talk about, obviously, living in a world where no animals are raised or killed for food at all. I very much hope that we live in that world one day. But I don't think I'm going to see that world. I don't think my daughter is going to see that world. I don't think her children, if she has them, will see that world. I think that world is a very long time coming. Whereas I don't think it's crazy to think that if it took 100 years to build the factory farming industry, maybe it'll take 100 years to dismantle it. And I think we're actually already into that 100 years as we speak, right? As I mentioned, you know, even just using the use of the battery cage as a kind of proxy for the worst abuses of just over the past 20 years, we've gone from basically zero, right, to 45% of the entire industry in 20 years. That's significant progress. I believe we could end the use of cages in the next 20 years. And now, you know, does that bring us all the way to the end of factory farming? Of course not, let alone all the way to a kind of vegan future, but that would be meaningful progress and a meaningful reduction in suffering for tens of millions of animals every single year. So I think that kind of progress is very doable on a maybe a shorter time period, right, measured in decades than people might think. And I think a kind of full dismantling of the industry of factory farming, right, and going back to something that might have looked more like the industry looked 100 years ago, I think is very doable, if not in my lifetime, but perhaps in my daughter's lifetime.
Makes me feel optimistic what you just said. I don't want you to be right, but still, you know, there's a positive spin to that reality. Yes, I agree with your assessment, but do you think we'll see more progress maybe in certain countries versus others? And maybe even we'll see in our lifetime the kind of world we wish existed, but only in a couple of countries.
It's certainly possible. I agree with you that industry change is very kind of geography dependent, right? A big part of our work at the Humane League is outside of the US. We coordinate a coalition of organizations called the Open Wing Alliance, which is about 95 organizations operating in 75 countries around the world, all working to end the use of extreme confinement in the factory farming industry. So in a lot of places that they operate, like sub-Saharan Africa, for instance, we actually haven't seen the full industrialization of the agriculture industry as we have in like North America and in Europe, for instance, right? So we're not so in places like that, we're not necessarily trying to dismantle a factory farming industry. Rather, we're trying to like prevent it from taking hold in the way that it has in other parts of the world. So actually another reason thing I feel very optimistic about is I think there are parts of the world where we could maybe prevent the full industrialization of agriculture before it even happens, you know, because they're just further along. They're not as far along in their journey yet. And that's actually quite exciting to think about. It's sort of a counterfactual way of thinking about it. But, you know, what if there were never wide scale uses of battery cages in some parts of the world, right? And we were to just head that off entirely. I think that kind of progress is very, very meaningful and very possible for sure.
Open Wings, I love the name. I wish to ask you about, you know, backyard chickens. This is something I covered on my show. I'm against it, you know. Do you think this is good PR for the poultry industry? That people, you know, cannot differentiate backyard chickens to the chickens they get at, you know, grocery stores, or at least they develop a certain insensitivity towards chickens because they are turned into farmers, or they get that farmer mindset. Do you have any reflection around that?
Yeah, it's not something we have a sort of institutional position on at the Humane League. It's sort of outside of our line of work. On a personal level, yeah, I don't think people should raise animals for food. And so I don't think people should raise animals for food. I do think that it, I think one of the challenges of things like backyard chickens or the kind of like, I do think it creates a perception that it's possible, right, to sort of at scale, right, at the scale of the hundreds of millions of animals, right, raise animals for food in a way that people would feel comfortable with. I don't think there is any version of that that's possible. And as you're saying, right, sure, maybe you can raise, maybe somebody with, who knows what they're doing can raise a chicken in their backyard and they can live a happy life. I don't know. You know, maybe that's possible, but it's certainly, like, I think it creates an unrealistic expectation that there's a version of that that's kind of scalable to meet the kind of demand, you know, of the hundreds of millions of people that live in this country. And I think there is a real risk with that.
Dan, I think I asked you everything I wanted to ask you. Did you want to add something before I stopped the recording?
I think we've covered most of what I had hoped that we would talk about. I think the main thing I would encourage people to think about is that there's a role for everybody to play in kind of bringing about this future that we've been talking about, right? And I do feel like, you know, again, I made the choice to go vegan 30 years ago. It's the best choice I ever made in my life, and I'll never go back. And I think it's important that we make those kinds of choices. And also, I think participating in the movement as an activist, you know, it is as important, you know, as sort of making individual personal behavior change choices. I think partially because, because I think it's important that these companies hear from everybody, right, who feels the way that we do about farmed animals, even if you're never going to buy a cage-free egg. I'm never going to buy a cage-free egg. And here I am advocating for companies to go cage-free in their supply chain, right? But I think the more vocal all of us are and the more visible we are with our beliefs and the more we translate our beliefs into pressure on the industry, right, both direct and indirect, I think the more progress we're going to make.
And I want more people to be, to adopt the same practical approach that the Humane League has towards this issue, which is a more nuanced and strategic approach, one that meets people where they are. I really like it. So if people want to, you know, support your mission or be part of this effort, what are the best ways, you know, for them to connect with you?
So folks who want to learn more about our work can visit thehumaneleague.org. And learn more about our corporate campaigns, the victories that we've won. They can find ways to get involved in their local community. They can sign up to be a part of our Changemaker program, where they can connect with other local activists in their area to take action to support farmed animals. And of course, we always need more financial support, as every organization does. We recently released a cost effectiveness study that says that it costs us 50 cents to free an egg-laying hen from a cage through our programmatic work. So even a donation of $1, right, will help us get two hens out of cages for the rest of their lives. So as people are thinking about, you know, their personal giving, especially at the end of the year, we welcome all the support that we can get.
Yes, it's Giving Tuesday, actually. And you know, yeah, be a part of the Humane League, be a hero. I kept thinking about the Justice League.
I like that part of our name. It does feel like it's a team you want to be a part of, you know?
Exactly, yes. So be a hero, be part of the Humane League, and join Dan in the good work that he's doing and leading. Dan, thank you so much for your activism. Thank you for having stopped by and discuss your amazing work. Truly amazing conversation. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, everyone, for listening. I kindly invite you to share this podcast with the vegans you know. Let's encourage more people to take action. Again, thank you so much for caring, and I will see you next Tuesday for a new episode.